good tape recorder and it picks up things well. How do you pronounce your last name, just so I always pronounce it correctly?
Cleaver.
Cleaver, great.
As in the beaver? Beaver Cleaver?
And you served with IVS for 3 years in Vietnam. And what years were those?
I went there in 66, and I left IVS in 69, but I stayed there till 71. Stayed in Vietnam.
We're going to pick that up as we go along. There are just some preliminary questions we always ask. What year were you born?
1942.
And in?
In Kansas.
In Kansas.
In a home.
In a home. You were born in the home.
I was born at
home. In the home. And where in Kansas?
Ulysses, Kansas.
Which is near?
It's 100 miles straight west of Dodge City, Kansas.
Okay. So near a great railhead of the American past. What was your family like?
Well, we had a large family. There were 6 children in the family. My oldest sister left home, when I was still young, to go to school. And then later on to get married. But we were a close family. We grew up not in a, I would say, financially needy family. My father was a dirt farmer. And we went through some very dry years when there wasn't any money. So, we all wore hand-me-down clothes. Got one pair of shoes a year. The new pair was for going to church, and the old pair was for every day. Grew up on a farm a long ways from, the nearest neighbors. In fact, in grade school, went to a country school. The last 4 years of elementary school, I was the only one in my class. So when I got to high school, it was kind of a shock to find that there were kids my own age. So when I got to high school, I was a very outgoing person, but when I got to high school, because I had been by myself so much, I was very shy. And that's pretty much my childhood, just growing up on a farm with brothers and sisters and a few cousins, and most of our activities were centered around the church. Mm-hmm. And the church and school. My mom used to say, when are we ever going to have a night for the family at home? Because we seemed like every night we were going to something.
And now there are all these entertainments that are available, and people just sit at home and never go out.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's true. The did you go to college after high school?
Yes, I went to college. Went to Tabor College, which is a Mennonite Brethren school located in central Kansas in Hillsboro, which is about 60 miles north of Wichita. I graduated in 64, and then went to Wichita State University for a year and a half to pick up a teaching degree in elementary education.
You always knew you were going into education? Was that?
No, that was, I come from a church that it's called a peace church, mm-hmm. that do not believe in active military service, taking up the gun. Our stand is not pacifism, it's non-resistance. So I wanted to go into some form of, back in those days, everybody got drafted. You served whether you wanted to or not. So I wanted to get into some kind of a service. Rather than being placed in something I wouldn't like, I wanted to do the type of service that I would enjoy, mm-hmm. and that I could find acceptable. And one deal was to work in an orphanage in Italy. But that deal fell through, and one of my college professors, who was an advisor of mine, suggested that he knew an organization called International Voluntary Service, which did the kind of stuff that I was interested in, and put me in contact with him. So I talked to them, and they said, yeah, they really weren't looking for people at the time, but most likely it would be involved in something in education. So I figured, well, I'll go back to school, because this was in my senior year when this deal that I had worked out and was planning for a whole year fell through. And I was sort of left hanging. So I went back to school, got a education degree, called IVS back, called them back and said, well, now I have a teaching degree. And they said, great, we're looking for 200 teachers to teach English in Vietnam. And so they sent Willie Myers to Kansas City, where I was teaching in an elementary school. And he interviewed me, and I was accepted with IVS.
You weren't married then or had other family connections?
I was single, living on my own, out on my first job on my own, after school. It wasn't just a summer job like I'd had some previously. But I was actually teaching in an elementary school. When I went to Kansas City, I had a choice. I could work a split shift at two schools in a blue-collar neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, or I could take an all-black school in a government-created ghetto. Now, in Kansas City, they had built these housing areas, and they put all their welfare cases and all the poor people in these housings, and it created a ghetto. It was so bad that the police wouldn't go in there at night. And I was supposed to go in there in the daytime and teach. But I figured that was the greater challenge. And what I found was generally the children were 2 years behind their counterparts in other areas. I had a tremendous discipline problem. I had the principal, he worked with me and worked with me and says, you've got to do better. Every week I had to come up with a new idea. It worked great on Monday, still worked on Tuesday and Wednesday. By Thursday it was falling through, and by Friday I'd lost complete control of the class. They sent a specialist there, a black lady, who was going to show me how to teach. So she came there. The first day, the kids were angels. The second and third day, they were terrific. On Thursday, they started to get out of control. By Friday, they knew her, and they went wild. And after she had been there for a week, she says, Mr. Cleaver, it's not you. I said, I knew that. And my last day of school, I went and I talked to the principal and went to say my goodbyes. And he says, Mr. Cleaver, he says, now you know what it's like. Now you know what we're up against. And I would have liked to have stayed there for another year, because I taught in the sixth grade. The fifth graders looked up to me, and they couldn't wait to get me as their teacher, because I had done so much. They saw that I had done so much with those sixth graders, teaching them tumbling and gymnastics, and I practically threw away all the textbooks and made my own to teach math, to try to get them back up to speed where they were supposed to be, and worked with their reading and reading skills. And a lot of them were really looking forward to it, and they came up to me and said, we're so sorry to see you're leaving. But by that time, I was committed to go to Vietnam, and I was sort of looking down the barrel of the gun to be drafted anyway, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, what was your reaction when they said, oh, we need 200 teachers to go to Vietnam?
Well, at that time, Vietnam was not so terribly much in the news. We had advisors there, and there was stuff going on there. And I had originally been told that I would probably be sent to Laos to work building schools, which was one of the reasons why I went to get a teaching degree. I thought, well, if I'm going to be working around schools, why not get a teaching degree also? And when I called them back up, and they said, yeah, we need 200 teachers. I was looking forward to it, and a lot of people says, you know, there's a war going on there. And at that time, it wasn't in the news, although some service, you know, it had gone from sending advisors there to actually sending troops there. And so my attitude towards the whole thing was, well, we'll see when we get there what it's like, whether we should be there or whether we shouldn't be there.
So you went out of a position of a kind of, you know, you're going to do some service somewhere. You know that education is some place where you can make a contribution. They want you to go to Vietnam. You're willing to go have a look-see.
Yeah. And my mother had a funny comment. As a child, whenever she'd fix rice, I hated it. I did not like rice. I'd eat anything but rice, and I had to be almost disciplined to be made to eat rice. And our way of eating rice was to put sugar and cinnamon and milk in it, kind of like eating a cereal. And she laughed. She says, you're going to Vietnam, you're going to have to learn to like rice. But when I got there, I found out that they fixed their rice different, and I did like it.
There's a parallel project I have just as a learning project for my students. I have them interview people who served in Vietnam, hopefully their own parents, because a lot of times their parents are service folk,
mm-hmm.
and they never talk about it with their own kids. And I always ask them a question, what did your family think when they heard you were going to Vietnam? Did they have an awareness of Vietnam? Other than just the comment on the rice, which is priceless, actually. Did they say, are you sure you want to do this? Or did they say, well, I guess you've made up your mind? What was their...
Well,
it's a big family. How did they think about it?
I grew up in a family that was very, should I say, democratically run. In that we were taught the way to go and the way that was right. And then it was up to us. And my mother didn't like it that I was going to Vietnam. But, you know, the day I left to go to Washington, D.C. for the training was on her birthday. And as they were driving me to Liberal, Kansas to catch a DC-3, which was the first commercial flight that I'd ever been on, she said, you sure are giving me some birthday present. But they respected what I was doing. And, you know, they really didn't discourage me, but my father never really said much. But, you know, my mother let me know that it wasn't what her choice would have been. But there was never a statement made like, you can't do this, why are you doing this? It was, you know... It was my own decision, and they respected that.
Do you have how many brothers did you have?
Three brothers.
Three. And what did they end up doing for their during that era?
Okay, my oldest brother did his service teaching school in Newfoundland, mm-hmm. and that was in a remote area. He said that it's about 300 years behind our time. It was his description. My next oldest brother was married at the time. He got married right out of college. And he went and did his service in South Texas on the border. Taught science in a mission school and worked with a church in a little border town. My youngest brother, of course, he did his service while I was gone, so I really don't know much about that, except that he did something in Omaha, Nebraska. But they all did something of their own choosing rather than letting it being dictated to them.
So you the next step was always going to Washington, D.C. for the orientation program.
Right.
And what was that?
Well, you know, I went there not knowing what to expect. And they worked with us. You know, we went through the orientation period. We went out to, what was the name of the little town in Virginia, famous for John Brown, Harper's Ferry,
mm-hmm.
Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, and had our orientation there, and we listened to people who had been to Vietnam tell their stories, and they told us about the culture there, do's and don'ts, and how to assimilate ourselves in the culture, which in our type of work was very, very important. And, you know, we got some idea of what we were going to be involved in, but no idea. It really wasn't. And then we went through language. When I say language training, I'm speaking of how to teach a language rather than learning a language. Mm-hmm. At the Institute of Modern Languages, there in Washington, D.C., spent about 3 weeks, if I remember right, actually, you know, observing, learning how, and then actually teaching with international students to learn what is the oral-oral method. It sounds the same, but oral being to hear and oral being to speak. You listen and then you speak. And we learned that method. We learned phonetics. And about the amount of time we spent in those 3 weeks would have been equivalent of about 8 hours of college
coursework.
Yeah, coursework. So, you know, we were trained to do what we went to do, and so, you know, we had some idea of what we were getting into.
Did you leave directly after the training? Did you leave for Vietnam?
Yes. I remember that time because we were supposed to make a stop in Japan for several days. We were all looking forward to that. And then there was that airline strike, where all the air carriers struck. And so we were delayed by several days, which cut our time. We were going to spend a couple of days in Japan. Now we weren't going to spend any time in Japan. Other arrangements had to be made with a foreign carrier. Instead of leaving from Washington, D.C., we had to be bused to New York. And that was a trip. The bus driver thought we were supposed to be there at 3 o'clock, and the plane left at 3 o'clock. So we just barely made it. And we had a block of seats. Well, they had given away those seats, and they managed to find other seats. So instead of being all together, we were scattered through the plane. And then we went to Hawaii. But we had a mechanical in San Francisco. So that cut down on our time that we were supposed to spend in Hawaii. We were supposed to get there in the evening and then leave at noon the next day, so we'd have the morning in Hawaii. So we didn't get into Honolulu until 4 o'clock in the morning. But I still got up early and, and swam at Waikiki Beach.
Yes.
Where I was out there swimming. And I must have been about a quarter mile from the beach, having the time of my life out there swimming in the ocean. And all of a sudden, my foot hit the bottom and I slashed open the top of my foot on coral. I stopped and I stood up and I was waist deep. I walked back to the shore. I thought I was out in the ocean. And then we did go to Hong Kong, although our luggage was all left in Honolulu. So we spent 2 days in Hong Kong, 1 day without any luggage or anything, because it didn't get there till the next day. And we got to spend 2 days in Hong Kong, and we did get to get into the Asian culture. And it was my first attempt at trying to eat with chopsticks. And I thought I did quite well. I managed to get the food from the plate to my mouth. And of course, the people in the restaurant were watching us and snickering, the waiters, and pretty obvious that we were doing this for the first time. But then I remember our first sight of Vietnam as we came into the country flying over it, and we were all looking out the windows.
How did you come into Vietnam? Did you fly from?
From Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
From Hong Kong into Saigon. And I would imagine, now on the trip that I just went there, we flew in at Vung Tau. But I think, if I remember right, we hit Vietnam in about Nha Trang, mm-hmm. or up in that area, as we were coming in and flying in.
And so you landed in Saigon.
We landed in Saigon.
And what was your first impression was as you landed, rolling along the runway? Did you see anything? Did you think anything?
Well, I was, I was just there, and it was the same thing. Saw a lot of military planes. So you knew you were in a war zone. There was a lot of security. And, it was all so new, and the hot, humid air.
When did you arrive? What month?
It was in July.
July.
So
this is July of 66.
July of 66. So, it's so long ago, that's been 30 years ago.
No, but almost everyone remembers the heat and the humidity when the door opens. Kind of sticks with
you. Not that we didn't have heat and humidity in Hong Kong because we did.
Right.
But it was... And if I remember right, also, there was a smell. I don't want to say a rotten smell, but, when vegetation is decomposing, that kind of a smell was around.
So when you arrived in Saigon, you were met by IVS personnel who did what with you?
Met by Don Luce. They loaded us up in their, they had those Jeep station wagons.
Mm-hmm.
And they loaded us up in the Jeep station wagons and took us to the IVS house. And, we were all wide-eyed looking at all this, as we were driving from Tansanyet to the IVS house. I remember walking from the IVS house to Tansanyet, and in some ways it seemed like it was very near, and some ways it seemed like it was a long ways. Now, when I was just there, I walked from my hotel, which was at the Tansanyet gate,
mm-hmm.
to the IVS house, and it wasn't that far. It was actually very close,
mm-hmm.
A few city blocks. But
it seemed like a lot longer then.
Yeah. And it may just be, even though we walked that a lot. When I got off at the airport, rather than taking a taxi, which would overcharge me, and we didn't have that much money, I'd walk. I'd have my shoulder bag, and I'd walk to the IVS house.
So now you find yourself at the IVS house. How many people were there when you were there, when you grew up?
Well, we had a pretty good-sized group with us. It may have been something like 15 or 20 people. And we got unloaded and grabbed bunk beds. And, you know, the girls over on their side and us on our, men on their side. And they took us out for our first meal was for beef served seven ways. That was our first introduction to the Vietnamese cuisine. And, of course, we were all ready to try new things. So we found out seven ways to fix beef. And it was, you know, I was impressed. It was quite good.
Mm-hmm. And you were then assigned to other places. How did that
happen? Well, we went through a little orientation period there in Saigon. And then we went to, the teachers were assigned to do language study I want to say Long Xuyên, but that wasn't Long Xuyên. That was now I can't remember the name of the town.
How far was it from the IVS house?
Well, this was down in the Delta.
Down in
so,
the Delta. Okay.
You know, we took a plane. Mm-hmm. To go from Saigon I should remember this because...
Oh, it'll come back to you, but also other people who went to the Delta will remember the name of the town. So.
Yeah.
So you went to there was a kind of a school set up to train IVS educators?
Yeah. We stayed in one of the volunteers who worked there, Fred Lynn, who was stationed there. They had a house and set up a bunch of bunk beds. It was a three-story house, so there was plenty of room. And we did our language study at the Technical Institute, which was near the School of Pedagogy, which was where Vietnam teachers studied. So we had interaction with student teachers that were from Vietnam as well as among ourselves. And we did that for 4 weeks. And we started, you know, we'd try our language on people. The kids loved it. the adults didn't have much patience with us, but the kids loved it, and they'd laugh at our pronunciation and try to teach us how to say it right, and so the kids were great. Of course, they were all interested in us anyway, so when we got to know you know, restaurants around there, even though there was a house across technical school where we ate. And I remember there was a great big jar of little white pills for stomach cramps and another large jar for diarrhea tablets. And that first month, getting used to the food and getting used to everything was the most difficult, and we did dip into those two jars liberally. At the end of the school, we were supposed to be there 6 weeks, but in Vietnam, they did stuff without much notice. And they decided that the school year should start 2 weeks early. And so they canceled the last 2 weeks of our language training, so we only had 4 weeks. At the end of that 4 weeks, I was up to my neck in language study. And I was sort of at a point where I'd hit a wall, where if I go to one more language training session, I'm just going to explode. Others, you know, they wanted more. But so we ended the language training and headed out to our assigned schools. And my school that I was assigned to had already started. It was because it was not on the same schedule as the regular schools, because it was an agriculture high school. So I was introduced about a couple of weeks after the school year had started. And I was assigned several classes. And I can remember the first time you get in front of that class, you know, you don't know enough Vietnamese to talk to them, and they don't know any English, and they're all looking at you, and now you get to put into practice what you have learned and how to teach language to people who don't speak your language and whose language you don't speak. And so, of course, you know, I was eager to start. It's something new, and I was really looking forward to it. And the students were shy at first, but they began to respond. They got the idea, and I had learned a few Vietnamese words like repeat and a few words like that that helped me through it, and I began teaching.
Okay, we've got tape. So you were at the Christmas party in Summers.
Yeah, over the back fence was the house that belonged to Madame Ngori Nu.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently a year or two before, when they'd had their Christmas party up there, some of the IVS boys had gone over through the backyards and invited her to come up there to the IVS house where they were having a hot dog roast. And there's a picture of Madame New in her white aozai with gloves and so on, holding this stick with a hot dog on it. Now, they claim, you know, makes a nice story anyway, that that's where she learned the word barbecue. Now,
okay.
Madame New, of course, is famous for, you know, when the Buddhist monks burned themselves of saying, I mean, using the term barbecue, referring to, you know, their self-immolation. So, Christmas...
Of course, I think she had been to the United States enough so that she probably picked up barbecue long before that.
Had she been to the States?
I think so. Had she?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Her English was very good. I mean, beyond textbooks, I think.
Yeah. Anyway.
But it's a good story.
Well, it was a good picture.
I'm sure it was a great picture. I'd love to see it.
So I stayed in the lot for a couple of weeks and was to have, you know, kind of on-the-job orientation with a fellow named Dan Leedy. And Dan Leedy at that time was just kind of finishing his IVS term and moving on to be the aid province rep. I stayed at the IVS house there. John Summer lived there. He was an English teacher. I remember with Dan Leedy, one of the places that he went was the Montagnard Agricultural Training Center at Dam Pao. You have to go down the mountain from the lot to close to where the airport is and take a right, which would mean going west and 20 or 30 kilometers down the road, and there was a special forces camp and a village and then this Montagnard Training Center nearby. When we were there, you know, there was a fire burning down a lot of the houses. Of course, with these thatch houses, they burned quickly. And Dan took tents and food supplies out of the USAID warehouse. He had old, must have been leftover World War II Army trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And they drove it down. I think this was on a Sunday or whatever, and I went with him. And on the way back, you know, the lights went out. And I remember going around those curves on that road and holding the flashlight out. That's how we got up. Luckily, there were no incidents.
Don't you drive like this, John.
Well, it wasn't safe to just stay there along the road.
Well, no, I know, but...
So then, I guess I went back to Saigon, and my team leader was Mike Chilton. I think he's out in Idaho or someplace like that, maybe Wyoming, Idaho, probably.
I think it's Idaho somehow. Yeah. When you said that, it clicked.
And I was assigned to Gwangduk Province, which is in the central highlands, largely inhabited by Minang people, an ethnic minority. There were some Vietnamese there, but not very many. There were, I'm trying to think, it was either 13,000 people or 26,000 people in the province. I mean, it was the least populated province in Vietnam of the 44 provinces in South Vietnam at that time. So I can't even remember. We couldn't drive up. I mean, it wasn't safe to drive up. I think that we flew to Banh Mi Thuit, and then drove from Banh Mi Thuit down. And who was there in Banh Mi Thuit? Roger Sweeney, working at a technical high school, I think, and Gloria Johnson doing home economics. Mike Benj was around somehow, although I'm not sure that he was in aid anymore. And of course, Chi was staying at their house. He was a high school English teacher at the time, Bui Zung Chi. He had been the interpreter and the language teacher for Don Luce and others. We went out to a village, a Montagnard village, a Rade village, and they had some sort of ceremony, and we drank rice wine. I didn't know what it was, and Mike Chilton kept telling him I wanted more because I liked it.
and you couldn't tell what he was saying.
Well, no, I mean it was fine. I didn't feel anything. The problem was,
until you stood up.
Well, it was something like that.
Yeah. I've had rice wine too, and it's fine until you stand up.
Actually, you know, there's a little anecdote back in Cambodia. We lived in a Cambodian house, although it was made out of wood, up on stilts. And this particular house had the under area, there was a cement platform,
okay,
which is where we ate and so on. And I think there may have been screens around it. But one of the early meals there, we all ate together with a Cambodian cook that, of course, was mostly rice and some sort of soups. And there's this little jar of things, and I asked what that was. And one of them, I don't know whether it wasn't Tom Wickham, maybe Harlan Gross, someone said, oh, that's like bacon bits or something. I mean, put some more on. I put two or three, you don't want just one, put two or three. It was the very small peppers. That are very, very hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I bit into, took some rice.
Make jalapenos seem like cucumbers.
And I was in total agony.
Yep.
The sweat.
And they were laughing.
They laughed for probably about 5 minutes. I could hardly breathe.
I've done that to people. Yeah.
I could hardly breathe. The sweat running off my forehead. I mean, drinking water even wouldn't do any good. I mean, anyway.
Plain rice and yogurt. That's the only thing.
They thought it was a great joke. I
mean, yeah.
Just trying to orient me, I guess.
Yeah, sure did.
So in Quang Duc province in Vietnam, there was one aid official, Bob Cormier. He was the aid province rep. And he may have had one or two assistants, but local people, Le Van Loi. So there was no place. There were about six cement houses in the province, in the capital, Zhang Yen. So Mr. Cormier and I stayed in the province guest house. It was not very, fairly close to the province chief's house.
Was this one of the cement ones?
This was one of the cement ones. I can't remember where I ate at that time. Maybe he fixed food or had somebody fix food for him. I was assigned to, you know, develop a Montagnard Agricultural Training Center. There was a program to do that in the various provinces in the highlands. There was a period of time where I tried to determine where this should be located in working with the province officials, principally the deputy province chief, Lei Quang Quy. The province chief was Lei Van Tan. Finally, it was determined that there was a site near the Special Forces camp at Bun Sarpa that would be appropriate. So I went out there and started work on trying to clear land and construct some. I think there was a building there that could be used as a dormitory. And then trying to hire staff or somehow get some staff that could be trained and set up some training courses and bring people in, working largely on vegetable gardening and trying to, one of the other main tasks was trying to work on training buffalo as draft animals. The Montagnards did not do that. They did not.
Sarpa?
S-A-R-P-A.
That doesn't sound Vietnamese.
No, that's Buon Sarpa. That's
B-O-U-N?
B-U-N, yeah.
Yeah.
That's...
Or is that Lao?
No, that's a Rade. That was in the Minong area, but it's that... The Minong usually call it Bon, but the Rade called it Buon. Uh-huh. Ban Ituat is Buon Ama Ituat, the village of the father of Ituat, which became corrupted to be Ban Ituat. I suppose the French just pronounced things more rapidly.
Yeah. And then it got shortened and lost the
Buon Sarpa. Buon Sarpa was halfway between Zhang Ye and Ban Ituat, which was about 120 kilometers, maybe 60 kilometers in can't even remember the name of the district. Tuklap district. About 11 kilometers away, there was a French tea plantation. There was no gas stations in Zhang Ye, so I had to drive to Ban Mi Tuat, every couple of weeks, and I had a couple of barrels that I put in the back of the Jeep and filled up with gas in Ban Mi Tuat and came back. So I got to see the IVS folks in Ban Mi Tuat quite often. We had had some training courses at this training center. And then one time I was coming back from Ban Mi Tuat with gas and supplies or whatever. I think it was August, maybe about August 20th or so, 1964. It was late. I should have started earlier. It was not safe. I mean, there was a war going on, although not much in that area. It wasn't safe to drive after dark, and it was getting close to dusk, and so I stopped at this Special Forces camp. And when I was working at the training center, I stayed at the Special Forces camp. Slept in the on a cot in the team house that they had. They had two team houses. This was a split A team. An A team has 12 soldiers, and so they were split. There were six of them were there, Buon Sarpa and the other. The other six were also in Quang Duc province at a I can't remember the name. Buprang. They were at Buprang, which was close to three frontiers, a little bit further south in the province. On this particular night, after we'd eaten in the team house,
mm-hmm.
the meals were interesting there. In fact, the fellow that was the cook there had been, used to be the houseboy for Don Luce.
Oh, really?
He really was not much of a cook, they ate kind of locally, and so they'd have fried chicken that would be in a bowl, and if people didn't really like the necks and some of the other things, they'd eat the parts they liked, and so when a new food was prepared, it was put in the same bowl. Pretty soon, then, after a number of meals, the bowl was just filled with chicken necks. Because the other pieces got eaten. Anyway, after supper that evening, the battalion commander, Imut, came in, and he said something about there's going to be some problems tonight or whatever, but don't worry, you will be all right. And we didn't know quite what that meant. It's like, does that mean there's going to be some sort of a Viet Cong attack?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had no way of knowing. I went to sleep in the team house. There were three or four bunks in one on the one side of the little central building where they ate, and then on the other side there were another three or four bunks. Anyway, about 1 o'clock in the morning, there was a lot of noise, and someone came in, and they told us to get up. I just remember that they kept saying, "This is our night. We kill Vietnamese." And it was a revolt of the Montagnards against the Vietnamese. It occurred in 5 special forces camps all at the same time. It was planned. Anyway, they marched us out. There was a lot of shooting going on inside the camp. There were maybe about 400 Montagnards in this special forces camp.
But the camp was Vietnamese?
No.
Okay. Well, then, what Vietnamese were they killing?
The officers.
Okay. All right.
The special forces camps had American advisors.
Okay, so it was really a Vietnamese army sort of thing.
Well, the Americans were the advisors
uh-huh.
to the Vietnamese military, who were the officers
uh-huh.
and the soldiers, in other words, the cannon fodder, were uh-huh. the indigenous population,
okay.
in this case the Montagnards.
Yeah.
So there were 4 companies, and they each had a Montagnard company commander, and there was a Montagnard battalion commander.
Mm-hmm.
But there were also Vietnamese officers.
Ah.
So okay. Usually when they went out on patrol, the Vietnamese didn't go. The Montagnards went out, and the Vietnamese stayed back. I mean, that created a lot of resentment. There were, the history of the Montagnards and the Vietnamese, I mean, there were many reasons why they felt that revolt, I guess, was the only way. The Vietnamese didn't give them much consideration, tried to change their names, did everything they could to, put them down. The history of Vietnam, no one remembers Champa. It was the kingdom of Champa. The Vietnamese kind of overran it, as one professor described it. The Vietnamese killed the men and married the women. So thus in Quang Ngai, Quang Nam, Quang Tin, the people are a little bit darker, and they speak more of a dialect of mm-hmm. Vietnamese, which was because it was a Cham area,
mm-hmm.
heavily a Cham area. And the Vietnamese had been more or less kept out of the highlands until after the end of the French Indochina War in 1954. And so, in fact, the French ruled it with a statut particulier,
mm-hmm.
Kept it as a kind of a separate area. Then the Vietnamese in 54, of course, then began to move up with a vengeance, if you will. The first thing that they did was created land development centers called Dinh Diem, which is very typical of the Vietnamese. If you look at how they moved from the Red River Delta in the early part of 800s, 900s, or whatever, and they moved slowly down the coastal area and then into the South Vietnam. they would establish colonies, maybe 200 kilometers out in front of where their population was. So they were called Dongdian.
Kind of Southeast Asia kibbutz style.
Well, they were established out in, you know, the hinterland for the purpose of, and then people who were criminals or, you know, misfits or whatever, you know, okay, well, here's your chance. You know, you go down there or, you know, you're in jail, that kind of thing. And it was a way of annexing territory. And they just kept doing that all the way down. Well, in 1954 or shortly thereafter, there were, of course, about 1 million Vietnamese came south from North Vietnam, largely Catholics. And so there were some of those that were established in settlements in the highlands. But also they had these Zindian land development centers. And they brought people from overcrowded areas of Quang Ngai, Quang Nam, Quang Tin, very heavily, densely populated on the central coast. And they put them in a series of settlements along the border in the highlands. So in Kon Tum, in Pleiku, in Darlak province, in Quang Duc, you had this, if you looked at it on a map, you could see that, you know, obviously it was a strategic consideration. Now they were, at least in Quang Duc, they were supposed to be planting rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And they had rubber trees. None of them wanted to be there. They were from the coast. And after I arrived in Quang Duc was after Ngo Dinh Diem had been assassinated, and I remember one of the early times going out with the province chief, Lai Van Tan, and he went out to one of these land development centers, and he was speaking, pleading, cajoling with the people, saying, please stay, you know, even, you know, we will make it better. And the aid province rep was trying to, you know, bring in supplies, bring in things to, you know, try to encourage them to stay. You have land and, you know, when the trees grow and start producing, you'll be better off. And I remember living in Zhangye, and we would see these folks, you know, walking with their, you know, that staff that the Vietnamese carry and bundles on their backs and so on. They picked up and walked back to Quang Ngai and Quang Nam. They just left those land development centers.
Didn't take it.
Well, they said Ngo Dinh Diem was the one that made us come out here, and he's dead, so, you know, we don't have to go, we don't have to stay anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. That doesn't get
that. That would be. So, did they feel insecure, or was they just didn't like the life?
I was foreign to them.
Yeah.
They were from the coast. They're lowland people. They're not the highlands.
Mm-hmm.
They were forcibly moved. I mean, forced resettlement. You know, even in Indonesia has never worked very well.
No, I was wondering if there had been a security problem at that time.
No,
it wasn't.
Well, I mean, there was some, but I mean, that's not why they were moving. It was not a security issue at all. Some of the settlements of people, the Catholics from North Vietnam, stayed, but they were not put out on the border area, like the land development centers, peopled by people. People coming from the central Vietnam. Anyway, back to Buon Sirpa.
Yeah.
They marched us to the team house. You know, it was a distance of probably 10 or 15 feet from the front of the building where I was sleeping. And as I walked there, I mean, they had their guns out, walked up there two steps onto the little veranda, and I remember there was a Vietnamese who was the interpreter for the Vietnamese contingent in the camp, the 10 or 12 officers, the non-commissioned officers. His name was Trong. And he was on the ground, and there was somebody standing there on the edge of the veranda, and the ground was maybe 2 feet below. And we were walking up the steps and then onto the veranda, kind of behind this Montagnard who was there. And he had a grease gun, that's what they called it, with a big long clip in it. And he unloaded that clip into Trong's back. Mm. And I remember his arms flew up and his legs kind of flew up. And I mean, he heard him yell something about no and or whatever. And anyway, I was scared excrementless. Because I thought that he was going to, you know, take that grease gun and just continue right around and, you know, eliminate us. He didn't. So then I breathed again, and they marched us into the team house. And we sat on the floor. They took my jackknife, because they said they didn't want me to commit suicide. Of course, that was the last thing in my mind. I didn't do anything like that.
You wanted to stay alive.
Yeah.
Oh, is John going somewhere?
No, somebody's at the door.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I was there for 2 days. I don't know. They were, at one time, I said I had to go to the bathroom and wanted to go out and take a leak in the there were outdoor urinals or latrine. Mm-hmm. Captain Darnell, who was the American Special Forces commander there, said, told me, well, I better not go into the latrine and just go out and pee behind the tree.
Uh-huh.
He'd been out earlier. Apparently, the Vietnamese that had been shot, they threw him in the latrines. And there were, there were at least nine in that. The firing went on for about an hour while we were there inside the compound. And of course, the Montagnards did completely take over and took command, and the Vietnamese that didn't resist or whatever, I mean, were, you know, tied up. The next morning, I remember they went up to.
So they didn't kill them all?
No. I mean, those that resisted, I mean, where
yeah,
they were fighting.
Yeah.
They went up to the district headquarters of Duc Lap and picked up the people there. Is that for us?
I thought it was.
You sure?
It was for Seth.
Oh.
Sounded almost like it was here.
Maybe it was here. It
would be really loud. Huh? Okay.
I remember one of the first things the next morning, well, of course, they had every weapon in that compound out, and you know, had their, they all had weapons on. And they said, Depir, Depir. And there were planes that came over, and they pulled their ponchos off their machine guns and submachine guns and so on. They were looking at that airplane. They didn't fire. He didn't quite come low enough. And it was an observation plane that was coming over to look to see what was happening. While we were there in the team house, the Montagnards, at one time someone came in and tried to explain what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke in French. And it was translated for us. It had a flag. It had three stripes. If you look in the National Geographic, where you see my picture, that flag is there. And it had three stars on it. And he explained that those, they called the moon Bajarako. And he said those three stars were for the three oppressed groups that have been oppressed by the Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
The Montagnards, the Khmer, and the Chams. Now, later on, you know, people had the interpreter, and they had some sort of a flyer, a manifesto. Later on, people said, well, that was for the three Montagnard, major ethnic Montagnard groups in the highlands of Vietnam, but that's not the way it was explained on that particular night. Captain Darnell tried to have radio contact with the other half of his team at Bu Prang, and what did they say? They had left or were leaving the camp. I mean, that camp had been taken over by the Montagnards there, and they were heading to three frontiers where they were supposed to meet up with a regimental size unit coming from Cambodia, which never happened.
Uh-huh.
But and the most of the or a large number of the soldiers from Buon Sarpa left sometime in the middle of the night after they had secured the camp and went to Banh Mi Thuot. We all sat and listened to the radio. They wanted to listen to the radio. The revolt had occurred in those two camps, also in Bumbrien, in Bandon, I think, and in Bujiamap, I think was the other one. They had Banmitut surrounded on Sunday morning, and at 7 o'clock they were going to take over Banmitut.
Uh-huh.
Banmitut was the headquarters of the Vietnamese 23rd Division. But the Montagnards knew that on Sunday morning the Vietnamese soldiers would all be asleep, which was certainly true. The signal for converging on Banmitut was going to be the radio station announcement at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
It never happened. When they took over the radio station, the Vietnamese who was in there apparently pulled some switch or pulled some plug, and
yeah.
So the radio station was
disabled.
Was disabled, and they never met. So they sat around Banmitut and never quite converged on it. Of course,
mm-hmm.
Then the Vietnamese became very concerned, and of course the Americans and whatnot. And it was very tense. The whole the revolt continued for about a week
mm-hmm.
and a half, and the Vietnamese put all of their energy into it. The president even coming up to Banmitut, you know, assigning generals and so on. I mean, they gave more attention to that than they ever did to trying to fight the Viet Cong. They initially tried to say it was, you know, Viet Cong inspired. It wasn't. It had nothing to do with the Viet Cong. I was in the camp on the helicopter came down from Banmitut the first day. A jeep came down, and some American, and said, gave us some news. Supposedly, this whole thing was being led by Ibrahim Inouye, who was a deputy province chief in Banmitut, who had been in prison for 6 years previously for, Montagnard rights activities. Although I don't think that he was really the leader. I think he kind of got drafted to. Because they were looking for somebody to negotiate with, the Vietnamese, and so they pulled him in as the most likely person.
Doesn't mean he had anything to do with it.
That's right, I don't think that he did. On the second day, a helicopter came in from Banmitut, and it landed just outside the compound. There was an American colonel, Fritz Freund, and he had something to do with Two Corps, and he came in, he started, I guess, trying to take control. He got up on a jeep.